Okay, I think we are live. Sometimes there's a little bit of a lag with YouTube, but good afternoon, everybody. It is good to be with all of you. It's Danny Haifong for another live stream here on the Left Lens. I am joined today by Margaret Kimberly, co-host. How are you, Margaret?
I'm good. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's been a busy time. It's been a busy time. We're gonna spend an hour or so, maybe a little more, with a very special guest, activist journalist Jackie Lukman. It's great to have her back on the show. We're gonna talk about the 2 year anniversary of the Black Lives Matter uprisings. We're gonna talk about our trips to Cuba and Venezuela. So we got a packed conversation. So I'm just gonna bring her on now. Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Hey everybody, how are you all doing?
Good. Good
All
to see
right.
you.
Good to see you all too. Good to be seen.
Yeah, good to have you here. So first, while everyone's here, make sure you're liking and subscribe, liking the stream, subscribing to the channel, all that good stuff, sharing it around. Make sure you're boosting that algorithm. Make sure that this stream is being seen. But yeah, I wanted to bring you on, Jackie, for a couple of reasons. The first is it's been 2 years since the Black Lives Matter uprising. I mean, since the beginning of the Black Lives Matter uprisings of 2020. And not many people are talking about this right now. I think part of that is there's a real crisis going on economically, politically in the United States. There's a catastrophic war happening that the US is instigating in Ukraine. And also, these issues tend not to get talked about as much, especially when it relates to racism and especially the black struggle for self-determination and the uprisings of 2020. I mean, where it was a really high point. And so I wanted to get your reactions 2 years onward now in terms of the black condition in America since then, your reactions to how things, your observations about where the movement has gone against police brutality, against racism. But I also want to pull up something really fast because I think what the Black Lives Matter uprisings, what they really generated was such a malicious response from the state. And this came in many forms. This came in the militarized police, literally mowing down protesters. This came in the form of just incessant propaganda against these protests being portrayed as nearly 100% riots. There was no support. There was bipartisan opposition. And then there was a lot of attempts to co-opt it. But I think this instance, the Louisiana Congressman Clay Higgins, he was a cop. He considers himself a reserve cop at this time. But he in 2020, in that summer of 2020, and so this is from Essence Magazine. And for some reason, I can't scroll right now. Okay, there you go. This was written December 6th, but he published this on his Twitter during the protests, where he said, or was it his Facebook? I think it was his Facebook, where he said that should protesters come looking like this, that he would shoot them down, essentially. So he said, nothing personal. We just eliminate the threat. We don't care what color you are. We don't care if you, sh but if you show up like this, if we recognize a threat, you won't walk away. So essentially saying that he would shoot down protesters. And this was kind of the atmosphere. This was kind of the attitude. So I wonder what your reactions are to that and to generally this 2 year anniversary of the protests that started with the murder of George Floyd and also remembering what happened to Breonna Taylor a couple of months before that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that the fact that people are not talking about this milestone really reflects where we are, where if we have a national psyche, I'm not sure that we do, but I think it reflects the realities of the damage that the white supremacist settler colonial project has done on the thinking of people in this country. Because people aren't focused on the fact that there has been no substantive, concrete material, tangible, measurable change in policing in this country in 2 years in any way whatsoever. There has not been, no matter how much people claim that all the left, the radical left, wants to defund the police, that did not actually happen. Some police departments reduced their budgets by almost negligible percentages. And a lot of those reductions, the ones that did occur, it didn't happen across the country in every police or law enforcement agency. And where it did happen, a lot of those reductions actually turned out to be due to COVID regulations, COVID reductions. So any reduction in police budgets were very small. It didn't happen across the board. Most of them that happened were due to COVID budget austerity measures. And where there was a reallocation of funds, the people in the communities who were most impacted by racialized police terrorism did not get to decide where those funds were reallocated in most of those instances. So this idea that the radical left wants to defund the police and they've defunded the police didn't happen. There has been no legislative change in how policing and the institution of policing is conducted. There are no more measures for accountability for killer cops. This idea that, you know, there has been Biden has signed an executive order on policing that was supposed to be sweeping and historic, and oh, it bans chokeholds, and chokeholds are already banned in most local and state police departments, and federal police departments don't even, that's not even a thing in a lot of federal agencies. So Biden's executive order focused only on federal law enforcement agencies. So it does nothing, it did absolutely nothing to address the problem of the kinds of cops who killed Eric Garner, the kinds of cops who killed Tamir Rice, the kinds of cops who killed George Floyd, the kinds of cops who killed Breonna Taylor. So 2 years on, after this massive worldwide uprising against police, racialized police terrorism, we have seen, I think, in this country, this government, led by a Democrat this time, definitively say that, no, y'all, Black lives don't matter. They really don't. I don't care how much you say it, they don't. Because we're not going to do anything to change this institution of policing to reflect that anybody's life matters more than upholding unjust laws and defending property rights that police actually exist to do.
You know, Jackie, not only did none of that change, but Biden has doubled down, allocating in the current federal budget $30 billion to law enforcement. And you are correct. Even those cities which claimed they were defunding the police, it was all smoke and mirrors. Here in New York, for example, they did not cut the NYPD budget. They just took the salaries of school security guards out of the NYPD budget and put it in the Department of Education budget and called it defunding or cutting the police. And to your point, this year, the number of people killed by the police is actually an increase over last year. Every year, it's pretty steady. 1,100 people approximately will be killed by police in the United States. And they even use COVID funding for police in New York, in Chicago. COVID money was used for police overtime. In Alabama, they used it to build they're using it to build a prison. So not only was that not true, but in the end, they undid the measures that people wanted. And we are now in a worse condition in that regard.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I don't want people to be defeated by any of this, because this is just how the empire responds to, first of all, its own decline, because you can't have an institution that kills as many people as U.S. policing does, and a legislative institution in the U.S. government and the courts that continue to uphold the rights of that law enforcement institution to take people's lives with impunity, and not expect people to stop and say, wait, I thought that this, you know, law enforcement was supposed to protect and serve me. So people are clearly becoming more and more educated on what policing really is, what the institution of policing really is, that it does not exist to protect people. And the Supreme Court continues to affirm that that's what policing is. I don't know how many times the Supreme Court has to issue a ruling in favor of police violating people's so-called constitutional rights, their human rights, for people to understand that the very law that we believe we are protected under actually protects the police to do whatever they feel like to us in their commission of protecting private property and enforcing unjust laws. That's really what policing in a capitalist country that started as a white supremacist settler colonial experiment, that's what they exist to do. And I think more people are waking up to that realization. But I don't want people to be dismayed or discouraged by that. This is the perfect point of organization for us, because while the media and the politicians are not talking about the 2-year anniversary or the 2-year commemoration of the public lynching of George Floyd, we organizing, we are talking about it. And we have to not only talk about it, we have to use this moment to advance and increase political education in our communities as to why this commemoration is important, particularly at this moment when the Biden administration is sending massive amounts of money to another country to continue an unjust war, increasing carnage on the streets of Ukraine, while we are still dealing with carnage on the streets in the US. And the same government claims it doesn't have any money to meet any of our material needs to address the issues that lead to the kind of violence that we see in these mass shootings. So this is a sobering moment for some people to realize what the empire really is under Joe Biden. It's the same empire that it was under as it was under Donald Trump. Sorry that your feelings are hurt, that, you know, we're not going to be able to push Biden any more left. That's not going to happen. What needs to happen now is that we need to seize on this moment and organize, redouble our efforts to organize those people who probably are very disillusioned that Joe Biden has turned out to be the terrible disappointment that we told you he was going to be. But okay.
Well, I'm glad you added that, Jackie. I think electoral politics is one of the things that killed that movement. That was the year of a presidential election. And Americans are politicized to vote. That's what we are, what we're told we have to do. That can be the extent of our political activity. And I think that election year took the air out of the room. The movement, I wish we had more time to talk about some of the problems with that movement, but I really think a big part of its disappearance has to do with this dependence upon electoral politics, and particularly that year in getting rid of Trump and seeing that as some sort of a panacea.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And that was always the weakness of, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, aside from obviously the financial issues that have arisen because of top-down leadership that was not accountable to anybody, which was a serious problem. There was also the very quick pivot from, you know, righteous anger in the streets among the people against racialized and class-based police terrorism, that immediate pivot to, okay, now channel your anger into voting for these progressive candidates who were elected and were propelled to Congress and have tried to do one thing or another, but we're talking about a Congress of millionaires that is really just intent on not ever serving the people. So electing one person from the organizing streets in Minneapolis is not going to change things in Washington. So we've seen what, you know, changing the system from the inside looks like. It looks like the system doing exactly what it has always done, which is ignore the will of the people and to violate the people's rights for their profits and the profits of their lobbyist handlers. So, you know, we have to also, while we have to be, and this is my personal struggle, while we have to be very cognizant that a lot of people that became politicized in the past, I'd say 4 years or at least since 2016 because of Bernie Sanders, they became politicized in a very electoral politics environment, an environment that fostered the idea of change being possible only through electoral politics. First, it was you have to elect Bernie Sanders in order to get any change. And then we got that message twice. And then it became, you know, the policing is, you know, a horrible, horrible issue in this country. And the only way we're going to change that is by electing Democrats or progressives. And so we've had several years of electoral politics focused messaging on societal change. So we've got a lot of people still very, very invested in electoral politics. So while we're organizing for actual societal change, which we know does not come through electoral politics generally, it can be a part of it. We also have to educate people on not relying on electoral politics and any politician that runs in any of these mainstream parties as an answer to any of these problems. It can be very tiring, but it's a very real multifaceted struggle that we're in when we're talking about educating people and getting people in organization who are passionate about some things, but are not organized and they're not disciplined in their ideology. So they'll just believe any kind of thing that sort of feels good and feels right at the time.
Well, I wanted to ask about something. So, I mean, what you're suggesting, and I agree with this, is that the duopoly, right, is not resolving the problem or the myriad of problems that were sort of expressed in the resistance of 2020. You know, they came to the fore. There was more consciousness around some of them, but I feel like what's happened is that through the way that the duopoly has behaved, the both political parties, the way that their elite handlers, the capitalists, how they have seized on the uprisings known as Black Lives Matter, I feel like there's been a lot concealed. Like, I wanted to ask you about this. Like, what is concealed by what seems to be kind of just like a forgetfulness, like a silence around the root causes for why people were protesting in the first place? Like, what you said that there has been no material change. Well, what hasn't changed? Could you tell viewers, like, what hasn't changed, especially for Black people in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, the incidents of police terrorism and the abuses of law enforcement against Black and Indigenous people hasn't changed, hasn't gotten better. It hasn't decreased. We're still seeing videos of cops either physically brutalizing people. There was a video the other day of a cop who literally put his knee on the neck of a pregnant Black woman and tased her in her pregnant belly. Now he's on leave. There's another video just the next day after that of cops in another state who stood by and watched while a man drowned. And one cop literally said to him, "I am not going to jump in after you." I mean, so one of the things that I think it has been hidden by particularly the Democratic establishment, the Republican establishment, they don't need to hide the fact that they're not ever going to change anything that relates to the decrepit material conditions of poor people, of Black people, of Indigenous people, of people who are not Republicans and will vote for them in this country. But the Democrats are playing a game of keep away with the fact that they are not doing anything to change any of those material conditions either, because they're beholden to the same corporate interests. They rail against the gun lobby, but they're beholden to the defense industrial complex. Same thing, only international, right? So when we look at the condition of Black people in this country, our net income, our average income hasn't increased. We haven't fared better economically under a Biden administration. We haven't fared better anywhere in this country under most Democratic leadership in most states or cities. That does not mean that Republicans are any better. It's just that we don't fare better or worse under the leadership of either party. And that is what the Democratic Party is hiding by not talking about these issues. The fact that we were told, particularly Black voters and white allies were told in 2020, you had to vote for Joe Biden to protect the Black people. You had to vote for Joe Biden because look at what Trump was doing to the Black people and the Indigenous people and the LGBTQ people and women and look at all the marginalized people that Trump was demonizing and harming even more. And voting for Biden was an act of harm reduction against those groups of people, particularly Black people. And now that we voted for Biden, the harm hasn't stopped, so none of the harm has been reduced. And as a matter of fact, Biden, who came in campaigning on promises that he would at least respond to the coronavirus pandemic differently and better than Trump did, he didn't do anything different from what Trump did in regard to coronavirus. And even more people, even more of our people died during this pandemic. And studies have shown that when white Americans found out that it was more Black and Indigenous people, people of color who were dying from this virus, they began to not care about any kind of regulations, masking. They don't care, let them die. And if you and I have this information, I'm sure the smart people on Capitol Hill had this information, but where were the harm reduction policies from Biden targeting protecting us Black folks and our Indigenous brothers and sisters from the economic degradation of Trump's policies, the COVID policies from the Trump administration, the warmongering? Biden is doing all of those things. So nothing has changed for Black people in this country under Biden. And that's what they're hiding. They're hiding the fact that their policies are no different from Trump's and that we lose no matter who is in the White House.
Thank you. Thanks, Jackie. That's all true. All I can do is amplify what you have talked about. But you, in recent months, have seen what more democratic countries are doing for their people. We're told America's a democracy, and there are countries that are, in fact, demonized, that we're told are ruled by tyrants and dictators, which actually do much, much more for their people. But that's why they're demonized, so that we don't we don't realize that we could have a much better system. Tell us about those experiences that you've had recently.
I mean, going to Venezuela was, it's one thing to be in the United States, in the imperial core, in the beating heart of imperialism, and know that people lie about countries like Venezuela and everything they say about Venezuela and the president of Venezuela being a dictator. You know that's not true. That's one thing to intellectually know that, to know the facts. It's another thing entirely to go there and see it and live it and feel it. And it was just, I mean, you know how people in this country, you know, talk about, oh, I love my freedom and all that kind of stuff, and how maybe we don't know what freedom feels like because we don't actually have it in this country, right? That was very different in Venezuela. I think the first thing I noticed when I went there was obviously how seriously they take COVID protocols. They are very serious about protecting their citizens and their country from COVID. So you get tested a lot, and I was thankful for that. And that testing, by the way, is paid for by the government. So yeah, that's great. And then I think the next thing I noticed in the first couple of days, I was there for a week for the International Summit Against Fascism in April. The first couple of days we were traveling back and forth to, you know, different places we were going, and we kept passing, you know, bridges and underpasses and everything. We were in Caracas, and I kept looking under the bridges and the underpasses for homeless people, and I kept not finding them. And that perplexed me in a country that is supposedly led by an evil, brutal dictator who hates his people and he's starving his people, and Nicolas Maduro is a tyrant, and actually he's not even the president of Venezuela. Juan Guaido is. It was just striking to me that in a country that was supposed to be led by this evil, brutal dictator, sure made sure that nobody is sleeping on the streets. I thought that was very striking for a country led by a dictator. And then when I met Venezuelan people and I talked to Venezuelan people, the first thing I noticed was that when you speak to regular Venezuelan folks and you tell them you're an American, if they're not a right-wing Venezuelan, they are very guarded about what they say, not because they are coached by the Venezuelan government, but because they know that the American government lies so much, they're not exactly sure about you. Right? So we have to be clear when we're talking to people in the countries that are targets of US imperialism, whose side we're on. We cannot just assume that we're going to walk up to people and say, hey, I'm American, and expect them to just, you know, or hey, I'm from the United States, because I never tell people I'm American. I'm not. I'm an African who lives in the United States. But we cannot automatically expect them to be, you know, just open and given just because we're from the United States and we want to talk to them. We have to understand the effect that U.S. imperialism and its lies and the sanctions and the brutalization of those people have had on everyday folks. So the thing I think that struck me the most when talking to regular Venezuelan folks was how aware they are of the role of U.S. imperialism and the sanctions and the lies that are told about their government that they elect and that they are very proud of. And they're very proud of the Bolivarian Revolution that they, the people, contributed to rewriting their constitution that the US government tried to overthrow, but again, the people came out and reversed that attempted coup. And they are extremely proud of that, but they are also very careful not to give too much, they're very careful not to entertain imperialist agents. And I absolutely don't blame them. So, you know, when you're talking to regular Venezuelans, you know, they'll ask you, oh, so you're from the United States? Oh, so what do you think about Biden? And you better tell them. I mean, you better be very clear that, look, I am an anti-imperialist. I do not like the U.S. government. Yeah. So, but people in Venezuela are, they are aware of the internal contradictions. There is poverty in Venezuela, just like there's poverty in every country. But the sanctions make it impossible for the government in Venezuela to address those issues the way it wants to. And the people are very, very aware of that. They have a system of political participation that is far more democratic than anything we have in the United States. If the Venezuelan people are unhappy with any politician, they can recall them in a referendum vote in the middle of their term. They do have right-wing parties that people vote on, and they have some presence in the government. But people overwhelmingly, the Venezuelan people are overwhelmingly in support of the Bolivarian government. So, I mean, it was just, it was a wonderful experience to go to Venezuela and see the lies undone, but also to see the effects of the sanctions on regular people and to see just how evil they really are in making people's lives that much harder, simply because the country's government is not capitalist and exist to provide for the people in their country. And it's just, the Venezuelan people are a beautiful people that are, they really just want to, as one person told me, to live and work in solidarity with other people around the world who want to live and work in solidarity with them. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you describe is a huge, I think, difference. It's much different than what we hear in Western media, U.S. media about Venezuela. I mean, could you talk about, I guess, the differences and what you saw in Venezuela? I know you were also in Cuba during the May Day celebration, mm-hmm. I believe. And both countries, Venezuela and Cuba, receive similar treatment, I think, in the U.S. media. Could you talk about the differences between how these countries are portrayed in the media versus what you saw? And how does this relate to racism? Because I feel like, I mean, racism is a global struggle. It's a global issue. It is a global system. How does it relate? Because I feel like there is definitely racial undertones to everything that the Western media and the U.S. media says about these two countries. So I'll just kick it back to you.
Yeah, I think that is very important. And it was something that I didn't realize until I went to Venezuela and I saw how Venezuelans see themselves. Venezuelans from Nicolas Maduro on down, unless they are really like the descendants of the former Spanish and Portuguese, I think, colonizers of Venezuela, and there are some of them who view themselves as white, Venezuelans can trace their lineage, many of them to indigenous Venezuelans, and many trace their lineage to Afro-Venezuelans. So when you go to Venezuela, you see, like in the U.S. media, you only see a portrayal, honestly, of people who look like Juan Guaido, right? When you know, you have people who are talking about Venezuela and talking negatively about, you know, the dictatorship and Chavez was a dictator and Maduro is a dictator. And it's always people who look like Juan Guaido. But then when you go to Venezuela and you see the public art, murals on walls or on buildings and the statues, you see that it is very indigenous focused. It is reflective of the indigenous and African heritage of the Venezuelan people. And then when you learn the history, you realize that Hugo Chavez identified himself with indigenous Venezuelans and Afro-Venezuelans, and so does Nicolas Maduro. So you have, and if you're just out in the streets in Caracas and you're just randomly just looking at people, most people don't look like Juan Guaido in Venezuela. Most people look more like Nicolas Maduro. Most people look more like Afro-Venezuelans. There are lots of indigenous. It's very obvious that Venezuela is not a white country. And this is part of the, I think, the impetus for the continued demonization of Venezuelan leaders as, you know, mindless, evil, crazy, despotic dictators. Because isn't that what the United States calls every leader of a non-European country that actually wants to govern for the empowerment of all of their people? I mean, people may not know that Hugo Chavez's greatest crime, aside from calling out the Bush administration for their excessive response to September 11th by saying that, you know, he literally said, you know, you can't defeat terrorism with terrorism. But when Hugo Chavez was first elected, he wasn't even a so-called leftist. He was sort of a moderate, sort of liberal. But then he realized that the United States wanted too much control in Venezuela. Capitalism was not going to serve the needs of the people. And the people who were left behind under the former right-wing government in Venezuela were the peasants, were the indigenous, were the Afro-Venezuelans. And the only way he could govern as someone who identified with those groups of people himself was to lift those people up from obscurity and poverty. So that's what he did. And it was a response to the U.S. And other imperialist interference in Venezuela that pushed really Chavez to basically say, you know what? Socialism is it. That's it. That's the only thing that's going to solve the problems of our people and not having anything to do with the imperialists. So when you go to Venezuela, and I encourage people to please, if you get an opportunity to go, take that opportunity. You see that we're not talking about a country full of people who look like Juan Guaido. We're talking about a country full of people who look closer to you and me, and their elected leaders identify with people who look like you and me. And of course, the U.S. Government and its white supremacist tendencies can't allow that to stand.
Thank you, Jackie. You know, right now the Summit of the Americas is taking place in Los Angeles, this meeting that happens every, I think, 3 years. And the U.S., the U.S. is hosting. And instead of acting as a host of every country in the Americas, chose to not invite Cuba, Nicaragua to attend. And it's the Summit of the Americas. It's not Summit of the U.S. if it's held in the U.S. So this was improper on so many different levels. And it's just one more way that the U.S. is attempting to delegitimize these countries, because, you know, if people knew what you just said, if people knew that these countries are trying to do the best by their people and that U.S. sanctions prevent them from doing so. There was a study that showed a couple of years ago that 50,000 Venezuelans died because of U.S. sanctions. So there's an effort to try to hide them and to continue these attacks. However, the U.S. was hoisted on its own petard when in their futile effort to sanction Russia, they now need Russian oil and have given Venezuela, and it's reported, it's not official yet, to lifted sanctions enough so that Venezuela can sell their oil to Europe. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, when I saw the news that the Biden administration would lift that one sanction on the one U.S. company that is in Venezuela still that does or that has anything to do with oil production, I actually said, you know what, you go, Nicolas Maduro. Oh, good for you, because here's what happens in this in this particular instance. The Venezuelan government is able to produce another stream of revenue to provide services to its people. This doesn't lift all the sanctions, not anywhere near, but it does give the Venezuelan government another source of revenue. But also, the Biden administration had to kind of de facto admit that Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela, because they didn't go to Juan Guaido to make this deal. And then there is the other juicy tidbit in this deal, that the person that the sanction was lifted from is actually President Maduro's wife's cousin. So Joe Biden literally had to crawl back hat in hand to not just Nicolas Maduro, the actual democratically elected president of Venezuela, but also had to make some concessions to his family. So I'm here for it. It's wonderful. And I think that in a way, by just not doing anything, Nicolas Maduro, once again, the Venezuelan people have, I think, one-upped the U.S. imperialist project. This is a small victory, but it is a victory nonetheless, for all of those reasons. In Cuba, in particular, with this summit of the Americas, it's such an insult that the United States government would pretend that it's carrying on this event to promote democracy in the Americas, when it excludes three countries that are in the Americas, as if the United States is the arbiter of what the Americas are. But we citizens of the Americas, we are determining, and we are saying, no, this is our Americas. This is Nuestra Americas. So this is not, you know, the Americas that the U.S. government decides who can be at the table and represented. So at the same time that the Summit of the Americas is going on with the exclusion of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, the People's Summit is going on, where representatives from all of the countries in the Americas are there. The people's representatives of those countries in the Americas are attending the much better populated People's Summit going on right now in Los Angeles. And that is a better representation of our Americas, not what the U.S. government determines what America is. Because if the U.S. government claims and continues to claim, and they do, that Cuba is not a democracy, then there is no country in the world that's a democracy if Cuba isn't a democracy. Having seen Cuba myself, and having seen yet another group of people in another country that are suffering horrendous economic devastation because of a 60-year criminal U.S. blockade against the country. Yes, they deal with very dire economic issues that show up in everyday life. But again, these are people who, if you ask your average Cuban, who might be angry at some aspects of, you know, the Cuban government, they also understand that their economic problems are the direct result of U.S. sanctions and the blockade. So they also represent a people that are generally a large, significant percentage who are Afro-Cuban, identify very closely with Indigenous and African heritage throughout the Americas, want to have good relations with other countries in the Americas and throughout the world, and are also very proud of their representative government. Cuba is another country that the United States constantly says is run by a dictator because the Communist Party is the ruling party in Cuba, but Cuba actually has a representative government. The president of Cuba, who happens to be Miguel Diaz-Canel, I think his first name is Miguel, but Diaz-Canel is elected, but he actually cannot do anything just because he's the head of the Communist Party. He can't do anything without the agreement of not just the rest of the party, but the entire structure of the government that starts from the block level and goes all the way up to the Communist Party. And that includes the communities in defense of the revolution. They vote for their block captains, if you will. The block captains then report to people in a structure higher than them, and those people report to national levels, and those people report to the party. And Diaz-Canel can't do anything without a consensus of the party and the people that keep the party in power. So Cuba has a much more representative government than we have in this country. There are no lobbyists in Cuba. There are no, you know, moneyed elites buying the votes or in writing legislation. Cuba just completed an intensive campaign where they educated the entire population on the new family code, where government officials went to every neighborhood in Cuba and held discussions with everybody in the neighborhood about quite literally what the government should say a family should look like and what protections that family should have under the government. And you know what they came away with? A family unit isn't just a husband and a wife. It's not just a man and a woman. It's where people come together in a loving and safe environment, and it's a unified unit, and the government will protect and honor that. Do we do that here in the United States? Are we still arguing whether a family is a man and a woman who have to be married, and two men and two women can't be considered a family, can't adopt children, and we're going to stop medical care for transitioning transgender children? When you go to places like Cuba and Venezuela and you see how the sanctions affect people's lives, but you also see how people are proud and in defiant opposition to the continued lies about their government, I mean, it really does give you a different idea of what freedom really is. And it really drives home the fact that we do not have it here.
Yeah, I was jealous. I'm always jealous for people who are able to go for weeks at a time. I was only there for less than a week in Cuba. And I was lucky enough, you were mentioning the medical care, the progress on transgender rights. I was lucky enough to actually just stumble upon a rally held by CENESEX for transgender rights. And it was an incredible, it was thousands of people, zero police in the streets, zero barricades in the streets. It was an incredible thing to see Afro trans people in the streets. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any of this. There's just there's just these debates that happen around transgender rights, around LGBTQ rights in the United States that seem so frivolous. And the same goes for every other issue, whether it's police brutality, right? The debates that happen in political discourse seem to skirt the issue, the mainstream to political discourse from the two parties. It's either fund the police more, that as Biden says, or if the Republicans, it's like, okay, we'll just shoot them down, mow them down, right? There's either co-optation or a complete and utter hostility while in Cuba, there are real attempts to improve things. And it sounds like you were able to see that firsthand, and that's incredible. So, I mean, my last question for you, and then maybe Margaret can chime in at the end too. What can we learn then? What can we learn, given all that we talked about when it comes to the struggle against racist policing, the 2-year anniversary onward of the BLM uprisings, and what you were able to see in Venezuela and Cuba? Like, what can we learn from that experience that you had, maybe it relating to what's going on right here in the United States?
I think the first thing that I would tell people that is extremely important is that internationalism is key. We don't win our struggles against this imperialist system in this country unless we are organizing and in solidarity with and struggling alongside with people internationally who are struggling from the effects of imperialism internationally. We have to develop international solidarity, because that's the only way we're all going to win in defeating this system, and to defeat this system for the benefit of all of us, right? And the other thing that I learned is that even when there are, you know, cultural differences or maybe, you know, religious beliefs or whatever, societies that are ordered on protecting the human rights of every single person in society is so ingrained in the people in that society that whatever petty disagreements that people have about whatever it is they have about people's differences, they just don't get in the way of ensuring that every single human being's human rights are valued and protected by that government. That's what I saw in Venezuela and Cuba. I'm sure people have certain ideas about, you know, whatever way people want to express themselves. But for most Venezuelan and Cuban people, the most important thing for them, maybe second only to protecting their overall government and their revolutions from US imperialism, the most important thing was to protect the human rights of all people in society and to ensure that everyone in those societies had the same level of protection by their government and were afforded the same level of respect and equal rights by their government. I thought that was refreshing. You know, that was, and it was life affirming. And I think that's it. That's it. That's the thing. We can have a society that is life affirming if we commit to ensuring that the human rights of all human beings are respected. I saw that happen and how it's done in Cuba. I saw that happen and how it's done in Venezuela. We can have that here, but we can only have it if we defeat US imperialism and we change this society.
You know, it's funny, Jackie, the term human rights here is never applied to this country. Mm-hmm. It's a term that's applied to other countries when the US wants to use it as a pretext for some sort of attack, an actual military attack or sanctions. We're told that this or that country does not respect human rights, but the term is never applied here. We hear about legal rights or civil rights, but the term human rights is one that has been erased when it comes to people in this country. And that's something that we need to assert our human rights and point out at every opportunity that they are not valued and not respected in this country.
That's true. And I think we don't realize that we do it, because this country was obviously founded on the idea that certain groups of people are less than other groups of people who have power and money and are able to oppress another group of people. That is the ideology this country was founded on. So of course, here we are, however many centuries later, some oppressed people ourselves, believing that we are somehow more deserving of certain rights than other people because we don't like the way we think other people live, or we don't like the way this other group of people expresses themselves, because that's the ideology, that's the foundation of this country. So we don't realize that we are literally projecting the violation of human rights of other people just because they're not like us. Because that's really what we're indoctrinated to believe, where we get our rights from. But it does not have to be that way. And we believe the narrative that that we get in this country, that the only way we get our rights respected is if, you know, other people's rights have to be ignored or downplayed or diminished. But when you see the opposite happen in other countries, that everyone's human rights are valued and everyone is equally protected under the law, you see that a society can operate differently. It absolutely does, like, literally feel different to be in a country where no one is afraid of having some vital human right like housing or healthcare or education denied to them because of what someone else thinks about who they are, how they express themselves, or, you know, the color of their skin, or anything like that. It's a better, I know it sounds trite, but a better world is possible. It is possible. And there are people in other countries fighting to maintain that better world, to improve on their societies. If only U.S. imperialism would leave them alone and let them do it.
Right. When you said life affirming earlier, it made me just think about how U.S. imperialism and its white supremacist system is really death affirming. I mean, with the life expectancy declining, COVID-19 just ran roughshod over the country, over 1 million people dead, 1,000 people, as Margaret said, more than that, 1,100 or so a year killed by police, at least a couple of hundred, if not 300 plus of those Black people. I mean, it's a death affirming society, and that's not even to get into the healthcare disparities and all the various economic issues that people are facing, which only compound on the stress and the exploitation. And as you were describing Cuba and Venezuela, I mean, these societies are moving in a direction of being a completely and totally life-affirming society. And it feels like what we can learn from them is, once we understand that, then we can ask the question, well, how come that doesn't exist where we are? And then how do we get it? Because we can easily say, oh yeah, we need socialism, because both of these countries are fighting for socialism. They've won some form of socialism, and that's what we need. It's easy to say that, but I think the question of how do we get to a life-affirming society inevitably leads us to then ask the questions and then find the answers to, well, how do we get to that? How do we get to a socialist reality here in the belly of the empire?
Yeah, I think, and this is the answer that nobody's going to like, because it's not feel good. It's not, you know, there's no easy way to get to the society that we want, because Cuba's road to their society wasn't easy. They got to it through revolution. Venezuela's road to their society wasn't easy. They got to it through a revolution. Venezuela was actually interesting because Hugo Chavez tried a military revolution. He tried to militarily overthrow the former right-wing actual dictator in Venezuela. That didn't work. And then he came back, started his own political party, and won election in a landslide by doing what? Grassroots organizing among the forgotten people in Venezuela, the peasants in the mountains, the indigenous people, the Afro-Venezuelans. That's how the Bolivarian Revolution came about. So none of these things are easy. We can get to a better society, a socialist society in this country, but it's going to require revolution. what kind of revolution it's going to require, that's hard to say. I think we're hurtling toward a physical revolution. The empire is crumbling. But in the meantime, we still need to do grassroots organizing among the very people who we want to benefit the most from this society, the working class, the poor, the indigenous, Black people, LGBTQ people. Yes, all of those folks, those rural folks who we think are right wing, you know, backwoods yokels, but are actually, you know, economically hurting working class people just like we are. Yeah, all that hard work of talking to people, organizing, door knocking, talking to people, organizing, political education, talking to people, organizing. That's how we get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Margaret, anything to close? I mean, we're getting about time.
I think Jackie gave us our closer. I can't add to anything that she said. Everyone should join an organization compatible with their beliefs. I'm speaking to people with an anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist orientation, of course, but that's absolutely true. And, you know, and these opportunities to go abroad, I visited Nicaragua twice in the past year, which had a sort of a hybrid experience of having a revolution where the Sandinistas won a military victory in a revolution and then had to be elected and then re-elected. So yes, it is possible. And I urge everyone who has the opportunity to see these countries. And actually, the more the US demonizes a country, the more you need to see it. So
yeah,
thank you so much, Jack.
Yeah, thanks so much. Well, before, I want to definitely get you to plug things, but I want to just read. I mean, I think that's going to be one part of the political education that we're going to have to do is mm-hmm. we're going to have to travel more to these countries. I mean, when I was in, I feel like I went to China for 2.5 weeks and it almost feels like everyone on the left just doesn't know, like has not been there either. And it's like, that's a big country that has been kind of like a focal point of globalization and mm-hmm. people haven't been there to see, well, what's actually going on. How is the government serving people? What is the actual situation? And, you know, I think these kind of trips going, be able to see what's happening on the ground and be able to report back with an analysis of, well, here is the actual context and situation, and here's how it fits into or lack thereof with the imperialist narrative, because I think that's a really great way to educate. I think. And it also builds people-to-people bonds and solidarity that is lacking. I mean, it's almost completely lacking in the citadel of empire and all of its allies, the United States and its allies. It's lacking so much because there has been such a tidal wave of reaction that we are climbing out of. And I think as things continue to move forward, the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the U.S.'s just absolutely devastating role in that, from all of the, from this failed summit of the Americas, talk about a crisis of legitimacy. It just seems like Biden over and over again just kind of falls on his face with a new example of it, the summit for the United States, it should be called. But it's a failure because it seems like the world is moving in a particular direction. A lot of countries, the most countries in Latin America came, and the Caribbean came to the aid of Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba and said, we're not going along with this. Even if we do attend, we're not going to allow this exclusion to be something that is accepted in public. And that's a huge deal, plus all the boycotts that happened. So there's a lot going on that I think we can contribute in, but it was really great that you were able to share your experiences because I think it's so relatable. But last word, Jackie, where can people find you and any last thoughts?
So you can find me every weekday from 2 to 4 p.m. On By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. You can listen on the radio at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. And I think you can pick that up on internet radio. But if not, you can find us on SputnikNews.com radio/radio. Click on the plus sign and then type in "by any means necessary." And you can find all of our shows there. And then two or three mornings a week, I am on the Remix Morning Show on Black Power Media on YouTube. And on Friday nights, most Friday nights, I have Luke Mon Nation on Black Power Media at 7 p.m. But I am starting a new podcast, a new show on Black Power Media, 1 o'clock weekdays. And I think I'm calling it Power Lunch with Jackie Lukman or something or other like that. But a few days a week, I'll be doing that at lunchtime at around 1 o'clock on Black Power Media. You can follow me on Twitter, Lukman Nation, the number one. And you can support me on Patreon at patreon.com/LukmanNation. And I think that's everywhere, I think.
All right. All right. Well, great to be with you all, everyone. It was a great conversation. We will be back soon with another episode. But please do, as you're leaving, make sure you're liking this stream, sharing it, subscribing to the channel, and hitting that notifications bell so you know when we go live. Take care, everyone, and bye-bye.
Peace out.